Our next presentation is going to take a different format. Randy Isaac and Walter Bradley are going to have a conversation in front of us. And they are going to model a conversation they've been having for a long time. And they apparently need a minute or two, so. Are you good?
Good.
You're going to be fast. So, one of the beautiful things, one of the beautiful things about the ASA is the ability to sit with brothers and sisters in the Lord and have a disagreement about what the science is and what it means.
How you doing?
Good.
Good to see you again.
Thank you.
All right.
It's good to be here.
So just a few words of introduction. Walter and I, for years, we'll chat at annual meetings or wherever we get together and have a lot of discussions, a lot of good time. And some of you may have read the exchange we had in the December 28, 2018 issue of the journal, where I had a letter to the editor responding to his article in the previous journal, and he rejoined on that one. And after that issue, we kept talking, as we usually do, a lot of emails, and we got the idea of, I think you suggested it, that we write a joint letter to the editor that we could send to Jim Peterson that would kind of help people understand where we agreed, where we disagreed. Because not that easy. We agree too much is part of the problem, and so people couldn't even figure it out. So we thought it was a fun thing to do. And so that meant we had to agree that each of us could express the other person's view. And it was a fun process. We thought we'd share that. We were almost done, and Walter thought we were ready, and I said, okay, I'll make one more change, send it in. And I added a sentence, and Walter said, no, I don't agree with that. Oh, and I went, what? I thought that was an obvious one. I thought we agreed on that. It never did get sent in, so nothing got in the June issue. But then Walter had the idea. I said, well, why don't we just continue this discussion at the annual meeting, and why don't we let some people sit in and listen if they want. So we'll tune you guys out. We'll just focus here a little bit on what's going on and kind of continue that conversation. I guarantee you we will not finish.
We've been working on it 4 years.
At least, yeah. And it'll be many more years. And the best thing is we're not debating, we're not convincing each other, we're not trying to argue in any way. There's no winners or losers, just winners. We both win when we understand more of what the other person is saying. And that's kind of all we're trying to do. And I think we've each been a little amazed to find out we didn't really understand what they were saying, the way it worked. Anything else you want to add before we draw the curtain?
That sets the stage very well.
Okay, so let's get going with that sentence that I wrote that you found problematic and surprised me a little bit. And what I basically said was that you and I agree on so many things, on creation and science and a lot of things. And I finally figured out all the nuances seem to be the same, that maybe our difference is one of emphasis. You know, that's all. The basics are the same. But what I said was, you seem to prefer to emphasize what we don't understand. I was referring to words of life and fine-tuning, things that are your masterpiece here. And I prefer to emphasize things we do understand, the comprehensibility of the universe and things like that. Seems pretty obvious. Why didn't you like that? What's wrong? Why doesn't that reflect what you're thinking?
I think it's it's pretty common for people, Randy, to suggest that people, for example, who look at fine-tuning and see that as a evidence for the existence of God are accused of choosing to believe that because we don't yet have a scientific explanation for it. Right.
Right.
And so, same thing with the origin of life. If you look at the origin of life, I co-authored with two friends a book on that way back in 1984. It's still available on Amazon. It's had a good lifetime, much more than I would have expected. And I think it is the case in the past that Christians and scientists have made really, really big mistakes by trying to explain everything we don't understand as being God working somehow in miracle. And so I think Randy's concern, which I understand and appreciate, is that there is a risk here, the so-called God of the gaps, right? And I didn't really want to be a God of the gaps guy either, okay? If you look at what's happened in the origin of life, at the very beginning, let's go back to 1860, there was a strong belief that life began how? Spontaneous generation. Life was real simple and it could just come into existence, and people actually thought some of the things that they were observing, even in experiments, confirmed that. Okay, and then Pasteur ran his famous experiment in which he showed that that wasn't spontaneous generation at all. It was pre-existing spores or some kind of a material that was already live and simply developed. And so that sort of put to rest what I consider to be the super simple idea of how life began. But then if you go further down the road, we begin to get people proposing in the early 20s that maybe life began, but it took a bunch of steps, which was probably in the right direction. Spontaneous generation said there was only one step. Then we did some experiments in the early 1950s, the Miller-Urey experiments, and here we found that we could actually synthesize some of the simple building blocks in experiments that mimicked the conditions under which some of these little building blocks might have been made. The further along we went, though, the more we began to find complexity and all kinds of issues. We got all the way up to RNA, for example, and DNA, and we're going, this is a really tough problem. I went to the International Society for the Study of the Origin of Life in 1986. I did two presentations there. But they had some things that I thought were very interesting. They had a debate on how life might have began, and you had the protein first people and the DNA first people, and they both lost the argument because both of them were very persuasive that that didn't work. Okay, so then we went on to RNA first, and at the conference there was a claim that RNA had been discovered previously, made in prebiotic experiments, and in fact one of the plenary speakers actually went through and did something I'd never seen before. He started with the most recent claim that RNA had been made under prebiotic conditions, and it turned out if you go read that paper, they didn't really claim to have done it, they just cited somebody else. And then the people, if you go look at the next article, it turns out that they had just cited somebody earlier, and it traced all the way back to one paper in 1968, and the people in that paper said we were trying to synthesize RNA under prebiotic conditions, but we could never do it.
Okay? Walter, wait a minute. Yeah. You're just proving my point. Okay. I mean, this is your shtick, right? I mean, you kind of always are focused. Your talks predominantly pointing out, hey, you scientists don't understand as much about the origin of life as you thought. We're finding out more and more stuff about what we don't know. Yeah. But why is that your emphasis? You know, because I don't get it.
Randy, let me finish where I'm going.
Well, I think the
more we learn,
you talk to me.
Well, the more we learn about the origin of life, the more difficult the problem has become. The things that we don't know are really what's compelling. What's compelling is the things that we do know. And so I would say what we've learned in the last 50 years about the origin of life has eliminated a lot of the naivety that was there at the very beginning. And what we've come to do through the studies, we've learned a lot. It's not that we haven't learned anything, but the more we learn, the bigger the problem gets. I would say that in most scientific investigations that are going to be demonstrating something that happens in a perfectly natural way, that what we don't understand about it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and eventually we feel like, yeah, we've got that explained. Okay, in the case of the origin of life, it was just the opposite. The more we learn, the worse the problem got. And today, that's pretty much where it's at. Okay.
So why then isn't your argument one of the more we learn, the more we realize we don't understand it? So that's kind of my question.
Well, I think the way you had put it and what you sent me was you really see evidence in the things that we don't understand. Okay? And I think some God in the gaps arguments are, we don't know what's happened here, so we don't understand it, so God must have done it. In fact, what I would say is, so in this case, it's what we've learned that has made what we don't understand get bigger and bigger and bigger, okay, so rather than smaller.
Okay. So help me. I've told you this before, Walter, okay, many times. All right. Because I've read a lot of your books, a lot of your articles, a lot of your thoughts. Okay. In most of them, 80-90%, you lay out the science, which is great. You're phenomenal. You really do a lot of homework and put that together. But then in the end, you say, and God exists. And seldom do you connect the dots. How do you get from there to there? How do you go from, we learn all this about origin of life and how hard it is, how much harder it is we go. How do you get from that to evidence for the existence of God? Connect the dots for me.
Well, let's go and talk about fine-tuning.
Okay.
For example, okay?
Yeah.
In the case of fine-tuning, I would say that when we look at the universe and say, what kind of a universe is this and what does it imply? I think that as I look at the universe, I see laws of nature that are very beautifully described by mathematics. I see universal constants that have to be very, very carefully prescribed. I see initial conditions such as the Big Bang, the velocity, that has to be exactly so. And as that list of requirements gets longer and longer and longer, to me, it makes a, let's say, naturalistic explanation for the origin of life, or a purely scientific explanation, more or less and less easy to appreciate. What I was going to show you on the computer is a list of about 15 books, all of which, when they talk about the universe, they're basically talking about the remarkable universe or the amazing universe or the, and it's interesting. In the paper that I had published about a year ago, one of the best quotes that I had in there was a fellow who is an atheist, well-known, writes books, and he says in his book, his most recent one, we've all been ignoring the elephant that's been in the room for a long time. And he's talking about fine-tuning. And he says, it's time that we come to terms with this, because the more times pass, the worse the problem gets, the bigger the elephant is, so to speak. And he was acknowledging that this is a real problem. And it's a problem that concerns him and it concerns a lot of atheists, because they see in all of the remarkable coincidences or by design purposes in the fine-tuning of, for example, all of the... Everybody calls it fine-tuning, everybody. The question is... what's the cause of that? Did it happen in some purely natural way? Did it happen in some supernatural way? I think that's basically the argument at this point.
Yes, I know you're very good at pulling out quotes. A lot of your talks, you fill with quotes from atheists giving that kind of talk. But they all remain atheists. They haven't been convinced by their own arguments. So. And I think there's a lot of metaphysical speculation, which is fine. But I have a little tough time seeing the argument yet in terms of how are you connecting the dots here? I mean, is a super long list of very precise constants somehow a stronger evidence for God than a short list of less precision? Or how does this argument flow from lots of precise cosmological constants to the existence of God?
I think as one looks at the whole, I actually... do not see this as a question of whether God did it or not. I see it as a question of how God did it. And I think one of the fundamental differences that you and I have is that you want to assume methodological naturalism a priori and presume that all of the creative work that God has done was done in what I would call his customary way, what we describe as the laws of nature. I think the laws of nature are simply descriptions of God's customary way of operating his universe, and miracles are God doing something in some alternative way. But I think I'm a theist, not a deist, and so I really believe that.
So much.
Yeah.
Yeah, we agree a lot.
Yeah, we agree a lot.
Solid agreement.
On the big points.
We got that.
Yeah. So it would seem to me that when I'm looking at the universe, I'm not trying to determine, for example, as some people might say, I'm not, in this case, trying to just argue, okay, the existence of God, but to understand how he did it. Now, let me share with you one interesting story.
Okay.
Many, many years ago, I was asked to be an expert witness on one of these lawsuits having to do what can we teach in school, and it didn't have anything to do with evolution, it had to do with other things. First question the ACLU lawyer asked me, and he was actually the head of the whole ACLU for the whole country, he said, Dr. Bradley, you're a Christian, is that right? Yeah, that's right. And you do scientific work, is that right? Yes, that's right. And you study things about how the universe began and so forth, origin of life, and I said, that's correct. And he said, but you can't really be objective, can you? Right? You can't be objective because if you believe there's a God, then that's going to really screw up your objectivity because you'll see everything that you can't explain being somehow a God of the gaps. Okay? And my response to him was, I feel like I'm the only one who can be objective vis-a-vis by comparison to atheistic scientists, because for the atheistic scientists, it has to come out in a certain way. In my case, I may find that everything was done in God's customary way, and I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm not really prejudicing. I want it to come out this way or that way. I'm simply saying, when I study the universe, it can be that God did it entirely in some patterned way. But to me, there are places, and I say the origin of life, and when I talk about fine-tuning, I'm not just talking about the constants. I'm talking about the mathematical forms that nature takes, the fine-tuning of the constants, fine-tuning of the initial conditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, that encompasses a lot. And so it seems to me, when I look at that, it may indeed be that with further study, we will ultimately explain how all of this was done in the customary way as the so-called laws. I like to call the laws of nature. I hate to call it laws of nature because it implies an autonomy, which I don't believe in. But let's say God, working in his customary way, has managed to make a universe that can have life, and do the many things that is necessary for us to exist in his customary way, or he might have done it in some part of it, extraordinary way. And so at this point, to me, it's an open-ended question.
All right, we've got so many loose threads here to follow up. Yeah, okay. We got to jump around a little bit. I want to get back to the fine-tuning a little bit later.
But okay, sure.
You made a comment about what you think I believe about methodological naturalism, which troubles me.
Okay.
Because I think for at least 5 years I've been trying to explain, and I'm doing a terrible job of it, I can't seem to explain to you methodological naturalism. So I let me just spend a little time on that and then come back to fine-tuning.
Yeah.
And maybe the best way, I think we can all agree that methodological naturalism, the term isn't a good one. I mean, there's a lot of problems there, but I think we all know what we mean by it, I hope. But the difference is of what you think, I think, and what I really think, is I think of methodological naturalism as being descriptive and not prescriptive.
Okay.
And you've basically declared that I think it's prescriptive. And virtually all your comments about MN and Steve Meyer and the ID community opposition to MN is all declaring that's an arbitrary rule and you should do away with it and open the doors and let it in.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that's not how we view it.
Okay.
That's a wrong description. Yeah, that's not what's happening.
Yeah.
In my opinion, MN is descriptive, which means that there's no rule. My thesis advisor didn't tell me, don't you dare do that. And there's no written rule somewhere that says, thou shalt not.
Yeah.
You know, he said that. The point is, you don't know how. There's no way in which you can explore something. But maybe I should reverse that question.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't like methodological naturalism, what do you call it? Is it methodological supernaturalism? What would that look like? How could you examine a supernatural cause?
Well, I would say that one of the things we've discussed, you did put that in your last email.
You did. I didn't. You didn't get a good answer yet.
Well, I didn't answer your email.
No, I know. That's why we've got a good here. This is a new answer.
And I'm
real accountable.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I think that if you're, by saying that you think it's descriptive rather than prescriptive, then you're not saying that everything has to happen in that way. Is that right? Or what do you mean by that?
I don't know how you jump to it. Everything has to happen or whatever. I'm talking about...
Just tell me what you mean by... I understand what you mean by prescriptive. What do you mean by descriptive?
We're talking about the scientific process. Right?
Okay, sure.
This is methodological naturalism. Science proceeds, you know, in what comes as a naturalistic way. Mm-hmm. That's been a misnomer. Some people call it... as if God doesn't exist, which I think is totally wrong. It's as if God has created the world in a consistent way, which I think is the biblical view of creation, that there's a coherence there. And I think a lot of us feel that this Christian view of doctrine is a key foundation of enabling philosophical basis for science. So the scientific method is one that studies the causes, the immediate causes, you know, of what God has created. But the methodology of science, you know, can't really handle supernatural causes. You can't. They're not accessible to be studied.
I completely agree.
Okay, so if you agree, why do you say it's an arbitrary rule? Why do you say it's imposed? I don't understand your concern with my methodological naturalism.
Well, I think that the concern that I have is that it is, until you, in your recent email, had made the distinction between being a prescriptive and descriptive. Mm-hmm. Okay, it seemed to me that there was a very tenacious, we'll ultimately find out how this can all be explained with more, what I think of as traditional science. And I don't have any objection to that. I'm perfectly fine if it turns out to be true. To me, it's a question of how God did it, not whether God did it. Okay. And so, if it turns out that it is done entirely by what we can describe through the laws of nature, then to me, I'm fine with that. For me, I like to start with it as a bit more of an open-ended question. And I like to say, okay, first default is what? Let's try to see if we can explain it in God having worked in his customary way. But there may be things, and I honestly think that fine-tuning, I think the laws that the origin of life represent things, that it seems like the more we study it, the bigger the challenge, the bigger the problem. We aren't solving the problem, we're understanding it better and finding that it makes how that might have happened in a completely natural way more difficult to explain.
Before we get off into that, back on the methodological naturalism, this isn't the first time, I don't think I've asked about it, but isn't the first time you said to me that I think that ultimately all things can be explained. I don't think I ever said that. I don't know if I ever felt that, because I don't know. I don't think everything can all be explained. I think there are a lot of things that we're not going to understand. So I'm not making that kind of assumption.
Okay. How do you define methodological naturalism? Because we have... I see it presented often in books and papers. Implies more than that, maybe.
I don't think so.
I'm talking about in general.
Yeah, I know. In general, yeah. No, I'm not in isolation. I don't have a unique definition of MN that other people don't.
You not think that atheists when they talk
there,
about
there are things problems. In science that we cannot explain.
I agree.
We may never explain. That's perfectly okay. MN doesn't say we will be able to explain everything.
Yeah.
We may not, you know, for a number of reasons, epistemological reasons as well as as more fundamental reasons. So that's not a presupposition here. Mm-hmm. But help me understand, how can anything other than MN work? I mean, how could you subject God's, I don't know what you saw, intervention for a lack of a proper word.
Yeah.
How could you even study that scientifically?
No, I think science, when we're approaching something to study it scientifically, we're going to assume this is something God did in his customary way. Okay? And the difference I'm talking about, though, is I don't necessarily cling to that being the assumption in perpetuity, no matter how the problem and the shape of it changes, Randy. So obviously, when I do scientific work, I assume that I'm trying to understand the laws of nature, which, again, I don't like that term. It's God's customary way of caring for his creatures. I don't need to presume anything but that until I get to a place of understanding and a place of recognition that the problem doesn't seem to be one that is ultimately explainable in that way. So I think we should stop
you right there. Okay.
Yeah.
So you said until we get to something that can't be explained, then what? Take one more step.
What's the next step? Well, I'm saying as the problem gets more and more and more intractable,
right?
Okay, and we find that the ideas that we had of how to explain this,
right.
It's interesting that all the atheists are worried about it because they think it's really evidence, okay, for what they don't believe in, which is theism, and they actually will say that in a very straight up way. So I would say that problems at the outset should always be studied on the assumption we're going to easily understand this in terms of the laws of nature. But I think when I look at, for example, the origin of life and what we've discovered in the last 70 years, if I look at what's happened with regard to the whole understanding of cosmology that we have today, it's a beautiful picture of a universe that's amazing in many, many ways. But it's also, I think, a picture that is not easily explained today, and maybe it will be in the future.
Jumping back to that, but let me keep your feet to the fire on this thing about what
feel the
happens
fire, so
on
maybe
the. I know I got to turn up the heat a little bit, but
I'm not getting it. No.
But
go ahead.
I can't put my finger on the difference here. There's something. You agree that scientific methods have limits and are not able to go beyond certain point on some things.
Well, you can't.
And what do you do next in your view? What should happen next?
Let me mention just a couple of things with regard to limits. I think anything that constitutes a bona fide miracle, and to me a miracle is God doing something in an extraordinary way,
okay,
are not going to be amenable to understanding using normal science. But we don't really ever assume that a priori. I think we assume that everything happens in a natural way and the laws of nature can be studied very nicely with scientific method. But if we have something that isn't part of a pattern, and which you can't, for example, run an experiment, collect data, make a hypothesis, run another experiment.
Right.
You can't scientifically study the resurrection of Jesus, for example. But there are other things that you can't study if they are unique.
Oh, okay, so if we come to that situation, what in your methodology would you do next? What's the next step?
Well, this is where I would consider something like inference to the best explanation, because I think this is not a claim that has the same confidence.
And what would that inference be?
Well, in the case of fine-tuning, I would say that the implication is, for me, that God did some of his creative work in ways that aren't a part of the pattern, okay? It seems to me that all of the attempts that we've made so far to explain how the universe magnificently came out with so many different details, all of which have to be just so, maybe I can say there's some way that happened in terms of the laws of nature, but on the other hand, it may not be the case. And so at this point, I don't think when people talk about inference to the best explanation, I think that's a way of looking at it. It's not saying
this isn't up yet. Not
yet.
Yeah.
Right.
I think that if you have a situation, and certainly the origin of life is one of these examples, I think, fine-tuning in its bigger sense, Randy, not just the constants, but the whole shebang, okay? Even the uniqueness of planet Earth. If I find that the more we study this, the worse the problem gets, and the more difficult it becomes to imagine how this could have been just simple laws of nature working in their customary way. And I think it's okay to at least consider that. At the end of the day, we will never know for sure how all of these things were done by one or the other. But I think at this point, I find some things to me look like they're
You do keep saying that it doesn't matter to you whether everything is done by laws of nature or not, right? That it's all kind of, God created it anyway. So you say...
Yeah, well, I'm okay with it coming out.
Yeah, you're okay with it coming out anyway. So,
yeah.
Okay, so let me backtrack a little bit. Just to clarify my view on MN and what it means is that when science gets to that point, it can come to the point where it simply says, we don't know. Mm-hmm. And that's enough. Mm-hmm. And if you're okay with that, then I don't understand why you object to methodological naturalism. It doesn't make sense to me. Because that process won't explain the totality of truth. And if you're objecting to MN because it can't cover those situations, mm-hmm. where the laws of nature don't cover it, mm-hmm. then I'm saying, why do you expect that of science? Then I'm concerned about scientism, that you're kind of expecting science to reach all truth,
yeah.
which I think we have to avoid. So science comes to a place where it says, we don't know. Now, if you want to go to all truth and get into the metaphysical space, that's a different realm. Okay? Now, that's a whole different matter.
When I talk about inference to the best explanation, I don't think that's science.
Okay. All right. Let's talk about inference to the best explanation. Okay. As I told you before.
No. Your time is getting close.
What?
It is. It goes really fast.
5:15, I thought.
Yes, but we promised these folks a chance to answer your questions.
We haven't even gotten started yet.
I know. It
always goes like this.
Is there something you would like to show in 3 minutes or less for how you ever wrap this up? I know it's an ongoing conversation that will last.
Yeah. But I just want to say, real quick, for inference to the best explanation, I've told you that phrase is meaningless to me. But it's always used defensively by the ID community, I think. But for one thing, I'll just say one of the things. Use the word best explanation. That assumes you have an explanation. That phrase is almost always used to say a creator, an intelligent designer, or whatever.
That's correct.
So the phrase implies that an intelligent designer is an explanation. I don't think it's an explanation. Because we all believe in an intelligent designer. We all believe in the creator. It is the totality explanation of why there is something rather than nothing. And as a result, it doesn't explain anything. You know, in the sense that it doesn't explain why is there A instead of B. You know, it doesn't do that. So I object because I don't think that is an explanation, and so it can't be the best explanation. Okay, so that was real quick. Now let me get the other one in. On the fine-tuning?
Yeah.
My question is this. I asked this in my letter to the editor in the December issue, and in your response, you didn't address it. And I was hoping you'd address it here. I wanted you to address this question. The question is often phrased, why is the universe fine-tuned for life? And my view is that in science, you have to ensure that you're asking the right question. Mm-hmm. The wrong question leads to meaningless answers. And I would suggest that that's the wrong question. And it's an illogical question in the following sense, that it presupposes a retroactive causal effect. Because the universe was formed 10 billion years before life, and if the way the question is phrased, you're assuming the existence of life 10 billion later has had some causal role in the formation of the universe. It's an awkward construct, let alone is the universe tunable and is there an agent to do it. So in my view, if you try to ask the question that way and you answer it must have been God, you really have a tautology and you really have no evidence at all. So my suggestion is, my question to you was, why isn't the proper phrasing of the question the inverse that says, why is life fine-tuned for the universe? Okay, because we all understand the precision of the factors, we all know that. But it seems to me the proper question is, why is life fine-tuned for the universe? Now in that case, the answer is easy. Evolutionary process is precisely that. that attunes life precisely to the universe. So why isn't that the right question?
Well, I would ask, Randy, if I had it, or the assumption here is any universe you have will accommodate some kind of life.
It will?
Well,
I don't know.
Well, you're saying that life just adjusted to the conditions that were there, and that had the conditions been different, then life would have been different, and it would have accommodated to those conditions. I don't really find that to be a very compelling possibility. It seems that so many things in our universe have to be so remarkable. If you look at the things that are necessary for life, the idea that you
can take almost be necessary for life.
But because we're trying to talk about why do we have life? Okay, we could have had a universe
life with no cause. The universe was
the most likely universe we would have had would have been no life. Okay, and I think everybody who
which is true for 99.9999% of the universe.
Yeah, that's a pretty good
percentage. As far
as we know. I would call that a high percentage.
We'll wait to find out.
Yeah,
Deborah gets
that. But we agree about that. So I would say that the idea that that whatever constants we had, whatever natural laws we had, whatever initial conditions we had, life was somehow inevitable, and it would have happened. It just would have been different. It would have been accommodated to that different universe. That's essentially what you said in the note that you wrote. You thought that life was accommodated to the universe as it was, and I would say that would be necessary, okay? But I would say that would be highly improbable, okay? Because it sort of sounded to me like almost any other universe will work, and life will be different in different universes. I mean, that was what I was reading. That was what I was understanding of what you were saying. I don't know what you wrote in your note, okay? Gave me
I keep changing my mind all the time, so I don't know what
I don't know. And on that note, who would like to ask these guys? They have lots of
We're going to be here until 10 o'clock.
I'm glad you're picking.
Jeff.
Jeepers.
And then we'll
somebody's out here?
Oh, my yes.
Goodness. So, Randy, I take it you consent that the majority of conceivable universes are not supportive of life, but then you ask Walter, what's the argument from that to God? And I want to ask both of you this question. Al Plantinga says that fine-tuning arguments are in fact not arguments in the Bayesian sense and are not inferences to the best explanation because we don't know the probability distribution of possible universes and we don't know the antecedent probability of God. So he calls them divine discourses, which he says are highly concordant with what we would expect of a creator and therefore offer support for a creator but are not demonstrative of it. And Walter, I want to ask you if you would agree with that.
Yeah.
And Randy, what's wrong with that?
Yeah, I would agree with that because, in fact, to make some of these claims, we need to know things about how much alternative kinds of life could actually have happened, okay? And if we don't know, in some sense, all the different possibilities, then there's no way to be sure how precise a lot of the fine-tuning needs to be. And so I would certainly agree with that.
Yeah, I would basically agree with that responding because I would say we really don't know whether all these parameters are tunable. We don't know much about it. But let me just make it very clear here in terms of how I view things, and that is that fundamentally, I don't see a path from a purely scientific analysis of the world to the existence of God. Okay, I know many of you are advocates of a scientific apologetic. I am not. However, to me, there's a powerful argument here that goes the other way, which says, if you affirm existence of God, I think this is what Romans 1:20 is all about, you know, in a context in which you're thinking of a God who exists, you're accepting that, you see his divine power and glory, because starting from God, the scientific world and its comprehensibility makes sense, you know, and it's coherent. So I start with the faith and go to the science, rather than start with the science and go to faith.
So both of you guys believe in something that has no natural explanation, the resurrection of Christ.
Amen.
And it seems to me that the difference, or part of the difference here, Walter's saying that there are aspects of origin of life and fine-tuning that also have no natural explanation. And Randy's saying we could come to a point where we say we don't know. But Walter's saying something stronger. We can come to a point where we can say there is no natural explanation. Is that fair, or... And Randy, would you... Is there anything that you would say we could come to a point in these questions where we say there is no natural explanation?
Are you saying there is no natural explanation possible? Right. I mean, I could say there exists none at this point.
Not that we don't know one, but there will be. There is none. It seems like that's sort of what Walter's saying.
No, I'm not saying that.
Oh, you're not.
I'm simply saying, based on what we know today, I don't know what we're going to know in the future, okay? And God could have done it any way he wanted. It may be that we will find that it's unlikely as it seems, based on what we know today, that there will be, ultimately, whether we ever discovered it or not is beside the point, that God did this in his customary ways, so-called laws of nature, or in some extraordinary way. For me, those will always be open-ended questions. There's no way we could ever get final answers on that, okay?
Yeah, and whereas, you know, I'm not doubting the ability of God to do things, I don't see any biblical basis for thinking that the past and the development and the evolution of the universe was done in extraordinary ways. It could have been, I don't know. Maybe we'll find out it is, but it just doesn't seem consistent to me with the biblical view of God and of creation. So there's a little difference here.
Yeah, and let me respond to that, okay? We're going to keep this thing. It's interesting that there is a tendency sometimes for people to want to have a God of miracles once we get into human history. But prior to that, we want a God who really always works in the pattern and is somehow compelled to do that.
Well, you argue strong for that in thinking that Christianity and Christian view of creation enables the ability of science. So put your view too strongly and you question the ability to do science in the first place. So I don't know, but the biblical miracles are of a different genre. I mean, they have no bearing, I would think, on past creative development.
And I don't think it puts science in jeopardy, because Jesus did lots of things. He did some miracles at the time he was here. Most things that were happened, you know, during his years here were things that were done not in a miraculous way. So the idea that I don't think it's accurate to say I'm putting science in jeopardy by saying
that. We'll continue that another time. That'll take too long.
How about, is there anyone who's here for the first time who'd like to ask a question? Oh, in the back, there, blue shirt.
Thank you so much. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, good. Okay, I really appreciated your point about a design hypothesis explaining too much, because the designer can design anything. I hope I'm characterizing that correctly.
Close enough.
That initially had some warrant, but I began to think about it a little bit more, because that seems to nearly prove too much, right? Because intelligent agents can always create other things, but that doesn't mean the best explanation of a car isn't Ford Motors, right? So I'm just curious if you might be proving too much that design is never the best inference, because designers can always have an infinite number of options by which they could create. So it doesn't ever explain the specific thing needing explanation.
So your question is there ever a case where a design
inference is justified? Because designers can always...
The inference is justified. Well, it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about an inference to a supernatural kind of designer, then I would be very hesitant. I doubt if that would happen, at least not within the scientific world. You really have to add a very spiritual, metaphysical adder to that. However, in the more general case, in terms of design, I mean, there are many examples how we can make an inference to the best explanation in terms of human design or internal design, or like we heard some talks earlier today, intrinsic or evolutionary design. There are a lot of things. But when you're talking about a supernatural or a non-natural designer, then I think not.
All right. I'm going to take the liberty of going another 5 minutes because there's a lot of questions, and I don't think
we can solve them in 5 minutes. Yeah, we can get those.
We'll meet you back here at 9 tonight. No.
Yeah, we probably.
Actually, if you'd like to.
I wonder if I could just make an argument that's kind of along the lines of design that's kind of removed from the science that you'd be okay with. If I were to just say, so something like modern cosmology seems to indicate that there's a need for some kind of thing that would predate the Big Bang that would give rise to our universe, that would be eternal, and it would be there necessarily. An eternality and a necessary being are both traditionally, you know, properties that we ascribe to God. And in addition to that, the universe appears to have emerged, like personhood has appeared to emerge throughout the course of, you know, the evolution of the cosmos. And that seems a bit strange if there's no, you know, it's very hard to think of how personhood would emerge from impersonal things completely. And, you know, putting those things together, maybe this eternally existing, you know, thing that exists necessarily might also be responsible for personhood. So it might be personal. And, you know, a lot of people believe in, say, objective moral laws, and so maybe, or at least a moral order. Maybe, you know, you can infer that, you know, you want to put in as few moving pieces into your ontology or your metaphysics as you possibly can.
Okay.
You know, maybe there's one explanation that can cover this kind of multitude of phenomena in our universe.
Well, once we get to metaphysical speculation, all sorts of things are possible. I don't know if you were here before for George Murphy's excellent talk. You know, you know, prior to the Big Bang, we can't say anything. And scientifically, we don't know. I mean, that's the beginning of time. You know, and so,
right.
But we can speculate. And we can, you know, and there's the ideas of the quantum vacuum. You know, in which things can happen. Where is that? You know, George can explain that a lot better. What is that? But when you start talking about correlating that with other effects, I don't see any.
So what I'm trying to do is make an inference to the best explanation, and just say like it's not a scientific inference. It's not that God is not.
Well,
a scientific
model. Where did we get the idea that an inference to the best explanation justifies a conclusion that has no evidence? I don't know. Yeah, you have to have some evidence for it.
Yeah, but the best explanation is always the result of evidence. People don't just make it up and say, I think I'm going to...
Where's the evidence on supernatural causes? All you do is you got the gap.
Okay, I'm going with two questions. This gentleman here has been begging me with his eyes the whole time, and then Dr. Weiss in front of me.
Many years ago, the president of the American Human Association was charged with having faith because he believed that everything that happened had a naturalistic cause. And to counteract the charge, the terrible charge, of him having faith, he says you don't need to assume that only natural causation exists. All you need to do is look for natural causes.
Mm-hmm.
And here out of the mouth of this atheist came the perfect definition, in my opinion, of methodological naturalism. You have to be able to look for natural causes as Christians, which means that there can't be any bias of the Christian toward a supernatural explanation.
Yep. I agree.
You have to have an equal. It could be either way. So you look for natural causes all the time within science. Science can only come to that conclusion.
That's correct.
But if it doesn't come to that conclusion, the conclusion that it will be left is, I don't know yet.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
And that's what frustrates me on the scientific descriptions of the origin of life, is that when they find some place out in the cosmos or something that has water and they just discover methane or something, they jump to the conclusion there could be life there.
Well, there could be.
All day. No, but not on that.
We don't know.
Yeah. They give the impression that that's all the evidence they need. Mm-hmm. Where, as you point out, it's a huge gap between that and the minimum amount of information that the organism needs to have to be alive.
But it was necessary but not sufficient.
Okay.
Yeah, so it's a step.
That's my point here. Is, yeah. I'm an evolutionary creationist. So if science finds out ways that the first life could have happened through nature, that's great.
Yeah,
I would celebrate that. Mm-hmm. But all I would like to see from science is a little bit of objectivity, because when you say a conclusion has happened without sufficient evidence, your credibility decreases. And and I think that is what has happened in science a lot in this case.
Okay, last question.
Tell me if I'm perceiving this correctly. It seems to me like the two of you have a different kind of philosophical take here, which is that Walter, while you say that it doesn't matter to you if God did it in his customary ways all the way through from the Big Bang through the beginning of life and all, that's just equally fine with you as if God did something kind of more miraculous. Mm-hmm. And yet, I really sense that when you talk about what atheists believe and all that, that you're really kind of hoping that God did something miraculous at these various points, because that would maybe be more persuasive of God. I don't know if you would put it that way. But whereas for some of us, we would see that God working through his customary way is actually more persuasive of a God who does things well from the very beginning. And so we're not kind of hoping that the evidence will kind of move more toward a miraculous, non-customary way when evidence for the beginning of life becomes more and more complex. Mm-hmm. So am I misperceiving the philosophical differences between the two of you on this point?
That's an excellent rephrasing of my first question.
Okay.
Yeah, much better.
At this point in time, I guess I would have to say I truly am okay with how everything's turned out. But I do suspect, okay, that God may have done some things in extraordinary ways. And if so, then I think in our very secular culture today, maybe that's purposeful, you know? Atheists also can embrace everything that we're talking about, okay? Nevertheless, they're kind of like, well, this doesn't prove anything. I can explain how everything happened as if explaining is describing. What they're doing is describing. They're not really explaining, because science is a description. It's not an explanation at a fundamental level. At least that's my opinion. And so maybe they draw unnecessary comfort from the idea that we can explain how these things happen. I'm sorry, we can describe how these things happen. And I guess it's my hunch. Jesus could have come and preached and done all the things that he did. He didn't have to do any miracles. Okay? But it's interesting, at the end of the Gospel of John, it says, many other signs that Jesus performed that are not written herein, but these have been written that you may believe that Jesus is the Christ, and in believing that you may have life in his name. And it's interesting to me that God himself in human history often used the acting outside of the customary way as part of his way of identifying himself and calling it to people's attention. It doesn't seem to me there's any reason I should assume it would be entirely different from that in prehistory. Okay?
Randy, what is your take?
Let's say that's an area where we completely agree on. We can abandon and agree on.